ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। हरे कृष्ण। टुडे वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम कैंटो 4, चैप्टर 31. चैप्टर 31 इज एंटाइटल्ड नारदा इंस्ट्रक्ट्स द प्रचेतास, एंड टुडे वी आर ऑन टेक्स्ट 18. तनेकमात्मनामशेषदेहिनां तनेकमात्मनामशेषदेहिनां कालं प्रधानं पुरुषं परेशम् कालं प्रधानं पुरुषं परेशम् स्वतेजसाध्वस्तगुणाप्रवाहम् आत्मैकभावेन भजध्वम् अद्धा आत्मैकभावेन भजध्वम् अद्धा तनेकमात्मनामशेषदेहिनां कालं प्रधानं पुरुषं परेशम् स्वतेजसाध्वस्तगुणप्रवाहम् आत्मैकभावेन भजध्वम् अद्ध तनेकमात्मनम् अशेषदेहिनां कालं प्रधानं पुरुषं परेशम् स्वतेजसाध्वस्तगुणप्रवाहम् आत्मैकभावेन भजध्वमद्ध तेन देफो एकम् वन् आत्मनम् अन्टु द सुप्रीम सोल अशेषा अनलिमिटेड देहिनाम् ऑफ द इंडिविजुअल सोल्स कालम् टाइम प्रधानम् द मटीरियल कॉज पुरुषम् द सुप्रीम पर्सन परैशम् द ट्रांसेंडेंटल कंट्रोलर स्वतेजसा by his spiritual energy, dvasta, aloof, guna pravaham, from material emanations, atma, self, ekabhavena, accepting as qualitatively one, bhajadvam, engage in devotional service, addha, directly. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Because the Supreme Lord is the cause of all causes, He is the supersoul of all individual living entities, and He exists as both the remote and the immediate cause. Since He is aloof from the material emanations, He is free from their interactions and is Lord of material nature. You should therefore engage in His devotional service, thinking yourself qualitatively one with Him. Purport. According to Vedic calculations, there are three causes of creation. Time, the ingredient, and the creator. Combined, these are called Tritayatmaka, the three causes. Everything in this material world is created by these three causes. All of these causes are found in the personality of Godhead. As confirmed in Brahma Samhita, Sarva Karana Karanam, Narad Muni therefore advises the Prachetas to worship the direct cause, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As stated before, when the root of a tree is watered, all the parts are energized. According to the advice of Narad Muni, one should directly engage in devotional service. This will include all pious activity. Chaitanya Charitamrita states, Krishne Bhakti Kaile Sarva Karma Kritahai. When one worships the Supreme Lord Krishna in devotional service, one automatically performs all other pious activity. In this verse, the words Svatejasadvasta Guna Pravaham are very significant. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is never affected by material qualities, although they all emanate from His spiritual energy. Those who are really conversant with this knowledge can utilize everything for the service of the Lord, because nothing in this material world is unconnected with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Om Ajnanatimirandhasya Jnananjanashalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahiyam Dadati Svapadantikam Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langayate Girim Yat Kripatamaham Vande Shri Guru Dinatarinam Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So we are continuing the read the conversation between Narad Muni and the Prachetas. So Narad Muni is instructing the Prachetas, and we are actually coming to the end of the fourth canto. It's going to end now, and very soon the fifth canto will start. So we know that the Prachetas had gone to do austerities, and they have been preached already by Lord Shiva. They have already met the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But now even Narad Muni also realized that he needs to now go and preach to them so that they can now leave their home and engage in devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in this particular verse, Narad Muni is talking about how the Supreme Lord is the cause of all causes. He is saying, as Prabhupada is explaining in the purport, that the supreme cause of all causes is Lord Krishna. He is the ultimate cause. Like in Brahma Samhita also we hear, Sarva Karana Karanam. So he is the ultimate cause of all causes. But in the purport, Prabhupada starts by saying that according to Vedic calculation, there are three immediate causes of creation, which is time, the ingredient, and the creator. So if we see in the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is very beautifully described in the conversation between Maitreya Muni and Vidura. In the fifth chapter, from the verse 26 onwards, it's described, where Vidura is inquiring from Maitreya Muni, that can you please tell me about the time factor of the Lord, or how the Lord creates this material universe? And in that particular situation, Maitreya Muni is very pleased with this particular question. And he is actually answering Vidura's question. He is telling him, I'll just read out a few verses which Maitreya Muni is telling Vidura. He is saying that the Supreme Lord, who is the undisputed proprietor of everything, was the only seer. So there was no other person in this creation. The cosmic manifestation was not present at that time. And thus he felt imperfect without his plenary and separated parts and parcels. The material energy was dormant, whereas the internal potency was manifested. So even the material energy was dormant and there was nothing happening, and the Lord had just he was the only seer present at that time. So further on, Vidura is being explained by Maitreya Muni. He's saying that the Supreme Being, in his feature as the Transcendental Purusha Incarnation, who is the Lord's plenary expansion, impregnates the material nature of three modes, and thus by the influence of eternal time, the living entities appear. So even here we are seeing that Maitreya Muni, when the primary creation is being described, Maitreya Muni is talking to Vidura about how the Lord was the only person present Everything else was non-manifest. And then by the influence of eternal time, he impregnated that material nature. And then, you know, it set into motion the whole creation, primary creation. Further on, he explains, thereafter, influenced by the interactions of eternal time, the supreme sum total of matter, which we know is known as Mahapradhan, and then it becomes Mahatattva, became manifested. And in this Mahatattva, the unalloyed goodness, the supreme Lord, sowed the seeds of universal manifestation out of his own body. So we are seeing that even as early on in the third canto, when Maitreya Muni is describing the creation to Vidura, he's explaining over there also about the three causes. The time factor is mentioned, the material nature, the pradhan becoming the mahatattva and breaking down into further mode of goodness, passion, ignorance, and the different material elements, 24 material elements. He's describing that over there. So we need, Prabhupada is explaining that these three are always required to work together for the creation to happen. Not only primary creation, if we actually look even at the secondary creation, the secondary creation is carried out by Lord Brahma. So there also we need a creator. Like after Lord Vishnu or Mahavishnu has manifested the skeletal, so-called skeletal, then Brahma takes over and he starts the secondary creation of dividing the material world into the planetary positions and all that. But even there it's the same three ingredients. Brahma uses the skeleton which has been created by Mahavishnu, and then he becomes the secondary creator, and again with time everything starts getting manifested in the material world. Same situation is there with demigods. So even when demigods are there, when they are creating, every demigod has a different department to handle. So when rain is created, so same principle is applied. The demigod is the creator, clouds are the ingredient, and with time we get rain. So the same principle is applied whether we consider primary creation, secondary creation, the demigods' creation, and if we talk about even the little creators in this material world. Coming down to the low, you know, in the material world to all the species of life, again, we see that there are the three causes of creation. So we consider the example of a human species. So we know over there that the father is the creator. The mother's womb and the father's semen become the ingredients, the material ingredients. And when the father sows the semen in the mother's womb, with time, a new human form is created, or any species we consider. This is the way the creation takes place. So whether we consider primary creation, secondary creation, or even in the material world, any creations which take place, what Prabhupada is explaining over here is present, ever present. The three causes of creation are always required: the time, the ingredient, and the creator. However, the problem is that in today's material world, people might accept, the so-called modern day scientists, they might accept the time and the ingredient, but they fail to accept the creator. And that is the biggest problem in this material world. No one wants to accept that there is a creator, or no one wants to accept there is a supreme cause of all causes. In fact, once when Devamrit Maharaj was speaking over here in Melbourne Temple some years ago, he was giving a class. He was saying that at least, you know, when we talk about atheists, at least they are caring that to go and prove or have a debate and prove to the world that no God exists. At least they are taking the care to do that. Or we talk about agnostics, which is the second sect of people who are skeptical. They don't know whether God exists. So if evidence is given to them or if it's proved to them, they will accept that God exists. So they are skeptical about the existence of God. But at least it's there in their thought process. They want to search for the evidence, and if it's given to them, they might accept it. But there is a third class, and obviously we know there are theists who believe in God. But Devamrit Maharaj was talking about a rising class of people which is called as apatheism. And I was actually looking this up when I was preparing for this class, and this whole sect has come up. It was introduced by some person called Robert in 2001. So it's a very recent sect that has come up, and it's on the rise. In fact, apatheism, if we call it a religion, it's the highest religion in the world today. And what is the meaning of this apatheism? The meaning of apatheism, if you look up on Wikipedia as well, it is explained that apatheists are people who do not care whether God exists or if he doesn't exist. They do not care. They are the I don't care type of people, which we see so much in the younger generation. If you look around in Australia, they don't care whether a God exists. They don't care whether God doesn't exist. It's just that it's not in their thought process at all. That is the whole sect which is coming up right now. So it is written in the Wikipedia that, you know, it makes no difference to them. It doesn't matter to them. So if there's a debate happening, and even if somebody proves God exists, or let's say the atheists won in that debate and they prove God doesn't exist, for the apatheist, it doesn't matter at all whether God exists or doesn't exist. It makes no difference to them. The whole pursuit is meaningless for apatheists. And why is this happening? Is because of lack of interest. That's what Devamrit Maharaj was also explaining, and it's given in the Wikipedia as well, that they have complete lack of interest. They have no interest in finding out whether God exists, no interest in finding out to prove or to even allow some part of their thought process to go towards that particular feeling, whether God exists or not. That is, and this sect is so much on the rise. When we talk, like even in my office, when I talk to people, I realize that it doesn't matter to them whether God exists or no. At least when there's a debate, it's mattering to people on both sides. Some people feel God exists, some people don't feel God exists. At least it's there in their thinking and in their consciousness. But this is a dangerous class which is coming up, which is apatheism, for whom it makes no difference, it's meaningless. This whole conversation is meaningless. And therefore it is so hard to get across to this sect of people. Because if someone at least, you know, has little bit of thinking about maybe there is things happening because of somebody higher up who is there, even if that thought comes in their mind, it's easy to then get through to these people. But the I don't cares, it's very hard to get through to these people. So this is on the rise, and no one wants to accept the supreme creator or the supreme cause of all causes. So yesterday Karunanidhi Prabhu was giving a beautiful class, and he was explaining that people are accepting, like today's modern day scientists, they do accept material nature. Like people like to go and see nature. You know, the whole tourism industry is based on that. Like people want to go to different places, go to beautiful beaches or go to beautiful mountainous areas, or go to New Zealand, for example, to see the greenery. So people do love material nature, and they do accept that material nature is, you know, manifesting or is the creator, according to them, of all these things. But they forget to ask whose nature. Like, you know, whenever I say nature, we always have to ask whose nature are we talking about, but that's what they forget to ask. And this material nature obviously belongs to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we see with these modern scientists who, you know, believe that material nature is the cause, or who always talk about evolution. Like, you know, we know in Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, which is completely brainwashing kids who are studying in schools nowadays. So even if we talk about evolution, in fact, in India, there was many, like in 2018 or something like that, one of the education ministers had said, get rid of this evolution theory. It is actually brainwashing our kids in the wrong direction, and, you know, teach them based from Vedas what is the actual evolution and how creation took place. But obviously, he was met with great rebellion against his idea, and people just shut him down. So I was reading Chaitanya Charan Prabhu's website, his spiritual scientist website, when I was preparing for this class. And over there, Chaitanya Charan Prabhu has very beautifully described evolution in terms of modern day science. So he has described that evolution can be actually broken down into three broad categories. And these three broad categories which he's talking about, the first one is called as adaptation of species. The second one is called as emergence of new species. And the third evolution theory, which he gives, is all explaining naturalistic evolution or naturalistic ideology. So we'll go through these a bit in detail. So what he's talking about is adaptation of species. So over here, he's talking about, and you know, I've seen this a lot when I used to watch the National Geographic channel a lot with Aditya, BBC series, David Attenborough series. I used to watch them with Aditya when he was young. The whole National Geographic series is about this. So adaptation of species is when plants like flora, fauna, or any animals, insects, etc., who are living in one particular region, they start adapting to the environment that is given around them. So, and you know, definitely this is an acceptable evolution. Like if we talk about adaptation of species and how species evolve and their, you know, characteristics change because of the external environment they are exposed to, that type of evolution is definitely an acceptable form, because there is evidence, science has been able to prove that this type of adaptation of species does take place. For example, if we look in the desert, Now, you know, in schools, we all were taught in India, especially about camels. Camel is a desert animal, and we had a whole, you know, chapter on science, how a camel's body has adapted itself to suit the desert region. He's called the, you know, king of the desert or whatever. So, you know, we were explained in science how his eyelashes, a camel's eyelashes are very long because, and something, you know, there's a double function, like a double layer on his eyes, so that because dust storms keep happening in desert. So whenever there's a dust storm, then his eyes actually have a natural layer which comes down and it protects its eyes. And obviously we all know about the hump of the animal where it can store lots of water, and that way the animal can go without water for days. And because in the desert, there is only thorny bushes and cactus and all that available, his teeth and his jaws have adapted to be able to chew those thorny bushes and cactus which is there in the deserts. In the same way, if you look at the flora and fauna of deserts, we find over there also that most of the species have adapted themselves such that they can store water, they can survive without receiving, because plants specially need water to survive. But these plants have learned to adapt and survive without water for many days. So definitely material nature has given this particular provision, like talking in scientist language. We know it's ultimately the Lord who's giving this particular adaptive nature to different species. But even speaking from pure science point of view, material nature has given this adaptive characteristic to all species. So that is there even in human beings. Like if you see so many human beings travel, there was so much of movement which was happening and people travel, they migrate to different places and they start adapting themselves to the culture that they have migrated to. So even human beings we see do that. Like people when they come to Australia, then slowly the accent starts becoming Australian, or if you go to Britain, your accent starts becoming British. So, and we start adapting to the local, you know, fruits, vegetables, whatever is available there. Like when we were living in India, we'd never heard of broccoli or avocados or anything like that. But now all that is part of our regular diet because we live in Australia. So that is how even human beings are given this ability to adapt. And this particular adaptation of species is called as microevolution, which is, there is evidence in science. Like I said, you know, it's there in National Geographic Channel. If you open up any David Attenborough series, he explains about this adaptation which continuously different species of life do when they are exposed to different environments. So this particular one is definitely accepted by science, and we also accept it. Even philosophically we accept it, that yes, adaptation of species continuously takes place, and that is called microevolution. But the problem starts coming when we talk about the second type of evolution, which Chaitanya Charan Prabhu was explaining, is the emergence of new species. So over there he was saying that, you know, because of this micro-adaptation, slowly there is a gradual change which happens in species, and we see a whole new species being generated. That is what he is talking about, the emergence of new species. So while the adaptation of species is called as micro-evolution, the emergence of new species is termed as macro-evolution. And that is where the problem starts coming up. So when we talk about macro-evolution, it is said over here that he was explaining that all the scientists feel that because there has been a slow change which has been happening, suddenly there is a new species which gets created. And that is what Charles Darwin is also talking about. He's talking about, like, slowly, you know, there was first the ape and the monkeys and all that, and then slowly they started adapting themselves to the environment that was presented to them. I still remember in my school days, in textbook, we had that whole diagram where it showed a monkey and then it showed standing up slowly and his jawline changing, and then suddenly a human being is there. So, you know, I still remember vividly that diagram which was taught to us in school in Charles Darwin theory of evolution, that the monkey adapted itself and then it became a human being, and then a new species has been generated. And this is exactly where the problem starts. So Prabhupada, you know, once was once told that, you know, oh, Charles Darwin, like Prabhupada would always have these debates with his scientists. They would, scientist devotees who would then become like a materialist scientist, and they would have debates with Prabhupada. So once during such a debate, one of the scientists was telling Prabhupada, but Charles Darwin has said that we have all come from animals and we have all come from monkeys and apes. How are you able to disprove that, Prabhupada? And Prabhupada then said, like jokingly, he said, yeah, his ancestors must be the apes. Our ancestors are all rishis and munis. We have come from humans only. And Prabhupada always used to challenge, this particular, the macro evolution theory which we are talking about, he used to say, okay, because of gradual change there is a whole new species which emerged, but then why are both species still coexisting? If we talk scientifically also, the earlier species is also still existing and the next one is still existing. Why are apes and monkeys still around? Then all apes and monkeys should have become extinct because they emerged into human species. So Prabhupada always used to challenge this particular theory. He had no problem, and the devotees have no problem philosophically with microevolution, but macroevolution is where the problem starts coming. Because scientists are not able to prove beyond a point the emergence of this new species, a completely new species, just because there were little adaptations that one particular species was doing. So, and therefore there is the third. So because there is a huge debate in scientists about, you know, scientists themselves are actually talking about this particular evolution, there are debates going on, and some scientists is disproving Charles Darwin's theory of evolution and saying that what is the evidence that because of a gradual change in species, the whole species got wiped out and a whole new species has come up. Where is the evidence? So even scientists themselves are having lots of debates among themselves about the second particular evolution, which is macroevolution. So embarrassingly, it is written that for these evolutionists, there is actually credentialed scientists who are debating with them, with people who believe in Charles Darwin theory of evolution. And this is evident. So, you know, Chaitanya Charan Prabhu has mentioned in his article that there is a website called as dissentfromdarwin.org, D-I-S-S-E-N-T, dissent, like having a difference of opinion. And if you see that website, there are more than 800 scientists who have actually debated that Charles Darwin theory of evolution, there is no scientific evidence for Charles Darwin theory of evolution. So although children are bombarded in school and they are taught about this, but scientists themselves are not believing. And this 800 number is ever increasing. There are more and more scientists who are joining the bandwagon of people who dissent from Charles Darwin theory of evolution. So on that website, the number is just increasing of, you know, they don't believe in this macroevolution theory. And therefore it brings us to the third stage of evolution, which is the all-explaining natural ideology, or naturalistic ideology, he calls it as. And here the philosophical evolution is explained. And that is what philosophically scientists are requested to accept. When philosophical debates happen with scientists and they are not able to provide evidence, this is exactly what devotees or people who believe that there is a creator, you know, then request the scientists to accept. So they are saying that in the presence of humans, other species, even evolution of consciousness, for example, no scientist has been able to explain the evolution of consciousness at all. And that is, you know, I was listening to a class also yesterday, and the speaker was speaking that even among scientists, there are some scientists who are theists and some are obviously who are atheists who don't believe in God. But even when the atheists are challenged that, okay, y'all are talking about evolution and y'all are talking about, you know, everything has happened, it's a, you know, body of chemicals, because of chemical reactions life takes place and all that, but what about consciousness? What is your discussion or what is the evidence that you can provide about the evolution of consciousness? Where did consciousness come from? So in fact, you know, if you see, the scientists claim that the whole material body is made up of just chemicals. Now you can buy these chemicals in the market as well. You know, H2O, water, oxygen, whatever, magnesium, phosphate, whatever minerals, everything it is made up of. And those chemicals, if you see the weight in the body of all these chemicals, if you go and buy them in the market, I think we might get it for maybe for a few hundred dollars. Not even that. That is also an exaggerated amount. But if you go and buy these chemicals, they might come in a few dollars. And is that the value of the human body? When scientists say that the human body is just a bag of chemicals, it's made up of chemicals, and that is how everything came about. So in fact, this question was actually raised. There was the 125th anniversary of a magazine called Science. And during the 125th anniversary, they explained the 125 questions, because it was the 125th anniversary, for which science has no explanation or evidence till date. And the second question over there was the origin of consciousness. So scientists say the body is, you know, made up of chemicals, because of chemical reaction creation takes place, and therefore, you know, human species are evolved, or that therefore material world is created because of a combination of some material elements. But where is the proof of consciousness which is there inside every human being or in any species, animals, plants, insects, whatever? How can you explain this origin of consciousness? So that is the second unsolved question in science, which was given in that magazine. And guess what the first one was? The first one was the origin of the universe. So this is also an unsolved question by science, the origin of the universe and the origin of consciousness. They are not able to explain that at all. And there are very nice examples which are given by famous scientists on how this origin of consciousness has not been able to be proved by science and what is the approach scientists should actually take up. So there is one Nobel Prize winner. His name, he's a neurophysiologist and his name is Sir John Eccles. So this neurophysiologist has actually written, he has said that if you read most modern texts on evolution, you will find nothing about mind and consciousness. No one is able to talk about mind and consciousness when they talk about evolution. They talk about ape has evolved into a man. If we accept that as well, but human intelligence is so much higher than an ape's intelligence or a monkey's intelligence. Human beings are able to do so much more. But that they are not able to explain scientifically, this evolution of consciousness or the origin of consciousness. So scientists assume that it comes automatically with the development of brain. Again, this Nobel laureate is speaking, that everyone assumes it comes automatically with the development of brain, but that is not the case. So we know, like, if we see in, you know, different human beings, there are different levels of consciousness which we can see with our own eyes. Pratyaksha Praman is there. Like many people we see, they are, you know, they have Down syndrome, for example. So some of them are having Down syndrome. If you see just the matter, the brain is there. The size of the brain might be similar to any other's brain, child's brain size or man's brain size. However, what do we see? There is a difference in the consciousness of a person who has Down syndrome and a person who doesn't have. How do you explain that difference? Even though the brain matter is there inside the skull, where is this origin of consciousness or this origin of the difference in the consciousness of two people? How does that science has no explanation for that? Also, scientists can explain how, for example, a law of order or law in the nature works, like why the sun rises and how the sun rises in the west, east, how the sun sets in the west. Or they might be able to explain that if you throw something high, it comes down by the law of gravity, and they will go to prove what is the, you know, in science we are all taught, like how do you calculate the gravitational pull of the earth and all that. But they are never able to explain why a certain law exists. So they might be able to explain how the law of nature works, but never they are able to explain why the law of nature exists in the first place or who created this law of nature. And that therefore there is, again, one more physicist called Paul Davis. He says that science can proceed only if scientists adopt an essentially theological worldview. Ultimately, scientists, famous scientists are coming to that. He's also a Nobel Prize winner. And he's saying science can proceed only when scientists adopt an essentially theological worldview. So we might accept all the laws of nature, we might say material nature is doing all this, but for us to be able to explain the origin of consciousness, or for us to be able to explain, you know, how, why laws of nature exist, we will have to have a theological worldview. And the theological worldview brings us back to today's purport, which Srila Prabhupada is writing about. He's saying over here that there are three creation, there are three elements which are required for any creation to take place: time, ingredient, and the creator. And that is what, you know, scientists, some of the scientists are ultimately coming to. They are also saying that we will not be able to prove the origin of consciousness, we will not be able to prove this evolution theory and how new species are emerging unless we accept a theological point of view that there is some cause which is actually setting this whole thing into motion. Unless we accept that there is, who, like, you know, behind this material nature, there is the owner or the creator of the material nature who's controlling this whole material nature, we will not be able to proceed and prove anything else scientifically. That is what the scientists are ultimately concluding. And coming back to today's purport, over here Narad Muni is telling the Prachetas, after he explains how there are these three ingredients of creation and how the Supreme Lord is the cause of all causes and he's the creator of all creators. So Narad Muni is telling the Prachetas that don't digress your attention to any other causes of creation. Because we see, especially, you know, coming from India, we know there are so many people who worship the secondary causes of creation. So the demigod worship is nothing but, you know, recognizing and, you know, paying homage to the secondary creator. We know philosophically they are actually below Lord Brahma. They are the third creators in the material world. But that is what demigod worship is all about. People are, at least they are accepting. They are not apatheistic like we spoke in the beginning of the class. They are accepting there is someone supreme who is sending the rain. They are accepting, like Navagraha Homam people do so much. They are accepting if you don't worship these nine planets or the owners or the controllers of these nine planets, we can get, you know, Shani Dasha will come and all that. People are saying, so out of fear or out of gratitude or out of acknowledgement that there is a creator, at least people are worshipping the demigods. But Narad Muni is telling the Prachetas, because he wants the Prachetas now to retire from, you know, ruling the kingdom. They've had their wife, children and all that. He wants them to retire, and he's telling them that directly worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yajjeta Purusham Param. Don't go for any other causes of worship. Further on, Prabhupada explains in the purport. Prabhupada says that, as stated before, when the root of a tree is watered, all the parts of the tree are energized. So therefore, according to the advice of Narad Muni, one should directly engage in devotional service, which this will include all other pious activity. So Prabhupada time and again talks about demigod worship in his purports, especially in Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada time and again warns that there is no need to worship anybody else apart from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because he is the root. He is the root of this whole tree of material creation. So we see, you know, watering the root of the tree is akin to the human body. Prabhupada many times explains the analogy between watering the root and the human body as well. So in a healthy human body, we know that different parts of the body are serving the whole body. For example, the eyes, when the body is healthy, the healthy eyes are directing the body, where to go, how to do things. The hands are doing the work, are working for the body or supplying to the body. The legs are carrying the body around, you know, wherever they have to, you have to walk, run, the legs are doing the function of carrying. The nose is doing the function of bringing in oxygen, which again nourishes the body. The mouth is doing the function, when the hands supply the food, the mouth does the function of chewing the food and then sending it down to the stomach. And then the stomach does the function of actually digesting that food and in that way nourishing the whole body. So we see that the whole body is functioning very nicely because different parts are doing their role properly. No one is doing hartal, we say, or a strike. I will not serve. They are not doing that. Everything works in unison by the design of the Supreme Lord. And what is a disease? Like, you know, just trying to understand this watering the root concept which Narad Muni and Prabhupada are talking about. So a diseased condition, like, I'm not a doctor, but speaking even philosophically or scientifically, a diseased condition is when germs or cells enter the body and they are not friendly to the body. They don't have the body's best interest in their mind. So for example, if we look at cancer cells. So when cancer cells develop in the body, these cancer cells are actually selfish and egoistic. You know, if we term it philosophically, because they are just thinking about themselves. They want nourishment and therefore they are feeding off even the healthy cells in the body. They are not realizing that in doing so they are actually killing the whole, the entire system of healthy cells, and ultimately the body will get killed. But the cancer cells are the selfish and egoistic ones who don't care about working cooperatively with the whole body so the whole body survives. But when these cancer cells enter, the other cells, the other healthy cells in the body who are actually caring about the whole body and who actually want to work for the, you know, nourishment of the whole body, they actually start fighting the cancer cells. And then it's a battle. So cancer cells usually, you know, unless, you know, the whole treatment is done and people's immunity is good, cancer cells usually, because of their selfish or egoistic nature, they are able to then eat away all the healthy cells and ultimately the body dies. And even if we consider a small disease like a cold or a cough, so we see, you know, a virus enters the body and then it is trying to fight inside the body. But if the body is healthy and if the body has lots of immunity in it, that body will be able to, the healthy cells in the body will be very able to quickly fight these dangerous cells or these dangerous viruses which have come into the body. And they will quickly be able to win. They will meet with success and the whole body will become healthy again. They will drive the cold away or the cough away or even the cancer away if it's, you know, detected early and the body is still healthy. The healthy cells are still there to fight. So, but the weaker body, a body which does not have enough strength or enough healthy cells or enough immunity, that body is going to lose the battle against the cancer cells or any other disease cells which might come into the body. So similarly, if we apply this whole principle of watering the root or nourishing the whole body, we apply it to the world. So this whole world or humanity is also like a body. And different parts or different segments of this humanity are actually like the different parts of the body. So just as all the parts of the body, of our own human body, are focused on feeding the stomach, because only when the stomach is fed, the stomach in turn will be able to nourish the whole body. That is what sometimes is missing in humanity, the body of humanity at large, if we see. So in a proper body, the parts are focused on serving the whole. In the same way, the different parts of society should be focused on serving the society as a whole. But we see that doesn't happen in society. Like in my office also, we have, you know, at Open Universities Australia where I work, they talk about three values. And one of the value is, you know, from shifting your mindset from me to we. So like every team has team targets, nobody has individual targets. So therefore, you know, the whole team should work together to fulfill the business needs, servant leadership. You know, all these things are so much there in the corporate world. So we are also talking to our teams, we are told, you know, change the mindset of people who are working here to adopt to the new culture and new values which we are trying to spread in the company, where everybody is thinking of we and not just me, like me, my selfish needs, how I want, what I want should work according to me, but everyone's working together with the we concept, that we are all in this together as whole. Or like, you know, McKinsey's, the seven values of McKinsey's, one of them is the core is the shared values. McKinsey's 7S model. So over there, he says the foundation is shared values, and unless people are working towards these shared values, you will have havoc in the society. And Prabhupada explains this example where, you know, people are not watering the root or serving the whole by a simple analogy of throwing stones in the water. So Prabhupada says that if different people throw stones in different places in the water, it's going to, obviously, whenever we throw a stone in the water, it creates ripples. But if everybody is throwing stones at different places, every stone will have its center and it will send ripples out, and all the ripples are going to clash with each other in the water, and that will just create havoc in the water. However, if everybody throws the stone in the same place, in the same center, it will just create a beautiful big ripple where, you know, the effects are just spreading out and no ripples are clashing with each other. So Prabhupada gives this a very simple analogy, and there Prabhupada explains like how, you know, we are talking about humanity is a body and how every function of humanity or society should be working together to so that humanity advances. So Prabhupada says that, you know, like those different stones we throw inside the river and they create ripples and there are clashes among the ripples. Prabhupada says that people nowadays in today's modern world are all like that. They are all selfish, like the cancer cells. They are selfish and egoistic. And like in my office, we say change mindset from me to we. They are all in the me mindset. Everybody wants to see how their own goal can be satisfied. So everybody is working in human society towards their own sense gratification instead of serving, being united and serving the center of society or center of humanity. And therefore, Prabhupada always glorifies, if we see in the Bhagavatam, he glorifies the Daivi Varnashrama system. Prabhupada says that in the Daivi Varnashrama system, all the Varnas and Ashramas are working very nicely together to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is at the center. They know that that is the whole that we have to serve. That is that center of the, you know, the stone being thrown in the center of the river and no ripple clashes happening. That is that center, Prabhupada says, in which Daivi Varnashrama system everybody worships. So they are different Varnas, there are different Ashramas, like we have different segments in society, but every Varna and Ashrama knows what their particular function is. So even though they might be Kshatriyas doing their duties, Vaishyas, you know, making money for the society, Brahmanas doing Yajnas, preaching and all that, or Shudra serving the other three classes. But for everybody, there is the, you know, like we spoke about the McKinsey 7S model. They have the shared value. They are working towards a common goal, which is pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in a society, if everyone is focused on gratifying their own senses instead of working towards satisfying the senses of the Supreme Lord, we will have the clashes which we see in today's society. There is so many problems we are seeing. We are seeing the results of collective karma of people also. Like, you know, all these things, especially the year 2020. Everybody is talking, it's been such a difficult year. Like, we had the bushfires in Australia early in the year. And then, you know, we have this COVID which is going on. So many devotees are affected. Many of their parents have lost their lives to COVID, and the devotees are not even able to travel back to India for the funeral services of their parents because they are stuck. So we know, you know, like, there is this collective karma happening. Especially 2020 has not been very good, and that is only because everybody is working towards their own selfish, egoistic interests. Like, I'm not talking about the devotees' parents, obviously, they are all blessed. But the society as a whole, we are seeing all this havoc happening because no one wants to. Rishikena Rishikesho Sevanam Bhakti Ruchyate. So if Rishikesha is the owner of the senses, and if everybody engages in worshipping the owner of the senses, we will see there will be so much peace and tranquility in society, because all of us are working towards the common goal. And that is what Narad Muni is telling to the Prachetas over here, that y'all don't get distracted by anything else, but only worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the cause of all causes. So even though there is time, ingredient and creator, y'all focus on the creator of all creators and don't get distracted by any other type of worship. Directly worship the Supreme Lord. Like we see, same, like Narad Muni wants the Prachetas to retire and go to the forest. In the same way we see earlier on, in the first canto, when Vidura comes back to preach to Dhritarashtra, Vidura is also giving the same message to Dhritarashtra. Like, he was very cutting. A sadhu is normally, that is what Narad Muni is doing, and sadhu's duty is to be cutting. They cut the knot of material attachment. So not that the Prachetas were materially attached, but they were, you know, still involved in their family life, ruling the kingdom, looking after the kingdom and the citizens, and that's where he wanted them to timely retire. And same thing, Vidura had come to preach to Dhritarashtra. He was very cutting, and he told him, you need to now stop living off the morsels of food which are thrown by your brother's children and go to the forest and worship the Supreme Lord. And that's exactly what Narad Muni is also telling over here. Water the root directly, worship the Supreme Lord directly, and everything else will automatically fall in place. You don't need to do any other pious activities or demigod worship or anything like that. So that is the gist of today's class. We'll end over here. Are there any questions or comments? Or you always have a question, Priya Mataji.
Mataji, I was just thinking of how people, how you were saying the I perspective to we perspective. So in our Shastra also we say that false ego, and we should not be in the I mindset. So I'm wondering, when they think of we instead of I, whether that is purifying or that is still bonding, causes bondage, because even though if they think of we, it might still, is it liberating or like not liberating, but is it purifying?
Very nice question, Mataji. So the definition of we is very important, and in what context it is applied. So when I was talking about my company, for example, the we is, you know, keeping the company goals in mind and everyone working towards the company goals. But obviously that is binding if, you know, someone's working, because we are still working towards a material goal. So therefore, this understanding this we is extremely important, whether it's a material goal or we are actually working towards something else. And therefore, you know, I was talking about the Daivi Varnashrama system and the shared values in the McKinsey's model, where everyone is working towards a common goal. So here, the in the what we talk philosophically, the shift from I to we, that we is where everyone's working together to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that we is the keeping the Supreme Lord in the center, and we all working towards that. So if that we mindset is there, where I'm not looking after my gratifying my own senses, but I'm working with other devotees to satisfy the senses of the Supreme Lord, then definitely that is liberating. So the understanding the we in the right context, the we concept in the right context is very important. Was that your question, Mataji, or?
Even in a company, if they do the we concept, ultimately it's based on me also, oneself also.
The company is the me.
Yeah, so it can't really be purifying in the true sense.
No, so that is a material example where at least the companies are telling, you know, servant leadership, it's all about this, where we are not just trying to... and. You know, like I manage a team of almost 10 to 12 student advisors, and it becomes a struggle because everybody wants their ends to be met. And then as, you know, the manager, or they have to ensure that everyone's working in a unified way towards achieving the company goals. It's a sales role. So obviously everyone has to work together. Somebody might be good in certain type of sales, somebody might be good in certain type of sale. So everyone brings their strengths and works together to achieve the company goals. So here the company is me, but obviously when we are trying, at least we are trying to shift their mindset from just selfish, egoistic, me, to working towards a shared team goal or something like that. But what when we apply to the Vedic context and we say aham mameti, like shifting that from my own sense gratification to gratifying the senses of the Lord, then definitely that is the we are talking about in Vedic concept.
Thank you.
And that is definitely then liberating, Madhuji.
Okay, and one more. So the scientists are now, you said they've come to a point where they're like, there has to be God, there has to be ingredient, what's the purpose?
Some scientists.
Yeah. So if people speculate about Krishna, I'm wondering if that will cause any good fortune for them, because Krishna is absolute. Whether we approach through fear or love or hate, whatever it is, we'll get benefit. So what's the fate of someone who will approach in speculation?
So just last week in our Bhakti Vedanta class with Keshav Prabhu was giving us an example where, you know, Prabhupada used to like to have all these eminent scientists and people who, Mayavadis, and everybody would visit Prabhupada and devotees would arrange meetings. So once there was a Mayavadi scholar who came to meet Prabhupada. And that Mayavadi scholar had studied our Bhagavad Gita very nicely because he wanted to prove to Prabhupada how Prabhupada is wrong. So he had studied the Bhagavad Gita very nicely and he came and sat in front of Prabhupada. And he started telling Prabhupada, because Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita is full of personalism, as we know, like full of mellow. He's always talking about Krishna as a personality. And this Mayavadis, we know, they will talk about the unborn within, and you know, it's very esoteric that they talk about, but they avoid using the word personality at all. So this Mayavadi came and started telling Prabhupada, see, in this particular section you have mentioned Krishna like this, but that is not true. So Prabhupada was continuously listening to him, and Prabhupada said, yes, where, what else have you studied? See, in this particular section you have spoken about Krishna like this, but that is not this thing. Krishna is not speaking, it's the unborn within who's speaking. And then Prabhupada said, okay, where else have I said? So like that, Prabhupada kept encouraging him, and that Mayavadi spoke for 1 hour. Continuously telling Prabhupada how his Bhagavad Gita he had, you know, written wrongly about Krishna and what should actually be the case. And then after 1 hour, once the Mayavadi scholar was done, Prabhupada told, like, then the devotees were waiting and watching. They thought, now Prabhupada will smash this Mayavadi. So after that, he told the devotees, please arrange some prasad for him. And then the Mayavadi scholar ate prasad nicely and he went home. And then the devotees came and asked Prabhupada, that Prabhupada, you knew he was a Mayavadi and you knew he was trying to blaspheme and find faults with whatever you have written in the Bhagavad Gita, but you still kept encouraging him, you kept telling him, read further, yeah, where else, what else have you studied? Why did you do that, Prabhupada? And Prabhupada explained, did you realize in that 1 hour how many times he took the name of Krishna? So even though he was a Mayavadi and offender, but he was keeping on continuously saying Krishna, so that has given him the benefit. So, like, coming back to your question, Mataji, whether in, you know, speculation or in mimicry, like, we know the famous verse which is there in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, that whether you'll worship Krishna out of fear, like Kamsa was always thinking of Krishna out of fear, or you worship him out of lust, like, you know, Kubja, she had lusty desires for Krishna, or you worship him out of pure love, like the gopis had, or you worship him out of friendship, which the sakhas of cowherd boys of Vrindavan had. So in whichever mindset you worship Krishna, you will definitely get benefit, because just that thought of Krishna is purifying and it will liberate you. Not only benefit, but it will lead you to your liberation. So even if someone is speculating, they will definitely get the benefit. Let them speculate. And therefore, if we see, like, you know, when I was meditating on this, the apatheism which I spoke about in the beginning, I was just thinking that because it is so much on the rise, especially in Australia, we see like most of the population is apatheistic. They don't believe, they don't care to worship the God. Neither do they believe, nor do they not believe. For them, it's a meaningless pursuit to understand whether God exists or no. And therefore, we see that our temple has so much, like Anirudh Prabhu, he wants so much Harinam to happen, and our temple is really good in that matter. We have so many Harinams that happen, because the only way then we can get through to these apatheistic people, who are those I don't care type of people, will, you know, putting the, somehow them hearing the holy name of Krishna. And during Harinam, you know, sometimes we distribute prasadam cookies and we do book distribution. So somehow or the other, we are just, you know, like we say, when we preach, we are, you know, we have to consider grass in three stages. So some grass is very wet, and when we put a matchstick to it, it's not going to light because the grass is wet. But the matchstick will at least dry the grass a little bit. And then if there is semi-dry grass, it will little bit lighter, but the matchstick will help in again drying. And as soon as you put a matchstick to hay, it catches fire. So people are also at different levels like that. These apatheists are actually like the wet grass. So even though we are putting the matchstick of Krishna's name, they are not going to maybe take it up immediately because they are still so wet like the grass. But the matchstick is doing the job of drying it slowly, slowly, slowly. So I was just meditating and I was thinking our temple does such a wonderful job of spreading the holy name, because at least the name of Krishna is falling in their ear somehow or the other, and it will help them. Definitely it will benefit them in the future. Any other questions? Okay, we'll end the class over here. Gantraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. Yeah.